All right, David Moore and Bob Nelson here once again. And we were talking about planning deals and successfully completing transactions. Today's marketplace, it's tight. Things are sort of, you better be set to go. If you don't have things locked up, they're going to go away. Sometimes they go away anyway.
Yes.
But if we look at the ID rules, and you've been doing this long enough, Bob, you've got an early CI number. But you think about pre-1991, people could identify virtually anything they wanted.
Right.
You don't want to identify a county, fine, do it.
Right.
And I think the old saying, you hear the saying, buyers are liars, and I think you know that sort of evolved out of that process. Yeah, I want your property. Yeah, I'm going to tie it up. Well, you better know where you are.
Right.
And in 91, we had a lot of tightening of 1031, formalization of it, and they gave us some ID rules, three different identification options that are there today. And you only have to meet one of them. You don't have to meet all three.
Right.
But if we look at the three different rules, you got the three property rule, 200% rule, the 95% rule. What are most of your clients work with? I mean, what do you typically see or what do you like to work with? I know you're probably not a fan of the 95% rule.
No.
It might put a little pressure on you. But
it puts a lot of pressure on you. Because you can identify as many things as you'd like of any value without a value limitation, but you have to buy 95% of that which you've identified. Well, what happens in one of the properties? A guy leaves and goes to Europe for 6 months and can't be found. Guess what? You've just blown that one wide open. To violate those rules is to cause the transaction to be fully taxable. So you can't afford to have that happen. It's an interesting process. So in advance of the time that we potentially even offer the downleg property, the property that I'm going to be going out of on the exchange, which I refer to as the downleg, before we offer that for sale, we need to come up with a game plan of how it's going to work, what we're after. Are we after a number of different properties, smaller properties that we might be exchanging our one property into, or are we after one that's even larger than what we have? And we're given an opportunity then to identify as many as three properties. So it's important if a person owns a property free and clear that they're selling and they want to stay free and clear, then that has pretty much defined what they're going to be doing. They're going to be exchanging same value into other assets. They could acquire more things, but they're not going to be acquiring very many more things because real estate's expensive as a single priced product. So most likely they're going to be sticking with the three property rule. That I have people that have done going from one big thing into a number of smaller things with the idea of they have debt on the one that they're selling and they would like to place that much debt, which they have to replicate in their exchange. They like to place that against only several of the properties and end up with other properties owned free and clear.
Yeah.
So it may be advantageous for them to have a series of things free and clear with all of the debt stacked against one or two things. It depends on the transaction. But it's really a function of where they're trying to go.
So I sort of encourage people, one example of a transaction we did years ago, somebody gave up a single asset, mm-hmm. bought 24 properties,
yes.
replacement properties. Well, the client was a CPA, and she knew the cost of a single sale fail. If you don't close 95% of the aggregate value of all properties ID'd, you're going to lose the exchange.
Right.
So she, with her background, knew, hey, I got to get it done inside the 45, so she did it.
Yep.
But with that said, you made an important point. A lot of times if we've got somebody coming in and they've got no debt, a whole nother conversation. We can talk about it in another video. The napkin test, value equity across or up. You're going to hear a lot of people say, well, you got to replace debt. That's not entirely true.
That's
debt can go away two ways. You can go down in value, which triggers taxes. You went down in value. The other way debt goes away is by adding cash.
Right.
When we had the recession, we had lots of people adding cash. The loan to value was decreased. Mm-hmm. The banks just weren't making those loans. And you remember, I'm sure you had lots of transactions where people were saying, well, gee, do I need to pay the property off prior to the disposition because I don't want any debt on the replacement? And that's really an irrelevant conversation.
Right.
You can always add money. So don't
right.
the debt itself is not a problem. What we're concerned about is value and equity. But what I was going to say, the point I really want to make is that you're not stuck. So often people come in, they say, well, hey, I can only ID three properties. I can only buy three properties. It's not true. It's never been the case.
Right.
You're working with the three property rule, the 200% rule, or that 95% rule.
And these are things that you need to know about well in advance of the time that you offer your property for sale. And frequently that sale results as an unidentified buyer walking through the door, making an offer to you on your property that you had never intended to sell, and all of a sudden it's an offer you simply can't refuse. And then you slam into gear trying to do a tax-deferred exchange, and guess what? And maybe that's a cash buyer and he wants to close next Friday. We have no opportunity to pre-plan that transaction. So it's kind of a hit and miss situation, and that's a horrible transaction to try to engineer. And I consider myself to be an exchange engineer. And if there's a way of doing it, and we have to buy several properties, I'm going to potentially go after the largest one first to eliminate the majority of the tax consequence. If I can't buy other properties, at least I've deferred the majority of the tax consequence in buying the very first one.
So what if somebody came to you, Bob, said, look, I'm giving up this property. I've got no debt on it.
Right.
But I want to lever into several different replacement properties.
Right.
Let's say one of them would satisfy the exchange.
Right.
Wouldn't a great solution be just to buy the one via the
exactly.
exchange and then do a cash out refi and lever in the balance of the properties in a period of time where you don't have time constraints?
Right.
And another benefit of that strategy would be that the purchase price of those other properties is now your basis. You're not deferring gains into
That's
those
right.
things.
You have a full stepped up basis because you've acquired the thing as a purchase. At the same time, if it has to roll as an exchange, and my client has been pre-approved by a lender to a certain amount of debt capacity, that has to do with their global financial position. It has nothing to do with the property. They have the capacity to service debt if negative cash flow were to occur. So they'll be looking at this person with more favor. So if I can go after the largest one that satisfies the exchange, and have the lender standing by with a certain amount of debt, I simply can either apply as much as is required to buy the property with this much debt opportunity left over. So what happens? I get to satisfy the exchange with the very first property, but with more purchasing capacity and borrowing capacity, now I can go after a second or a third property, and it makes it a rather interesting process.
So let me ask you this real
yes.
quick. So if you're working with the 200% rule or the 95% rule, we're talking
right.
about values.
Right.
What if the property's not on the market? What are you telling people? What are they worth? And,
yeah.
and you know, I joke with brokers all the time. I say, well, of course you have to have a broker to sell a property or list property. And you know, if I go back to the audit manual that we had in roughly 1990, late
right.
80s, talking about 1031s, one of the questions was the property on the market at the time of identification, which is irrelevant. I mean,
That's
it
right.
means nothing. A property
That's
doesn't
right.
have to be on the market. So how often does somebody say, hey, I want this thing,
yeah.
and it's not on the market? How
yeah.
often?
Well, and on top of that, let's take it one notch further. Let's say that you're going after four or five or six properties, which is allowed by the 200% rule, and you've marked down on a piece of paper that property A is worth this, B, C, and so forth. You add them up, and it is below the 200% of your sale price. So restated, that qualifies. What happens then if you've marked down this property is $500,000, but in final negotiation you had to pay $600,000 for it? What's just happened? You've gone over the top. What happens if you violate that rule? That is an unforgiving rule. So it takes a lot of skill and negotiation up front to make sure that you're within the capacity of qualifying for the exchange. And if anything goes wrong, you may have a bombshell that all your good work as a broker goes right down the drain, and of course the client's not pleased with your name from that point forward because they've just incurred tax.
Well, I appreciate the conversation, and you know, something else that people don't think about is you know, that 45-day time period is critical.
Yeah.
You've got to have things set up. You got to be committed come that 45th day to either completing the transaction or not completing the transaction. And we'll talk about that again in a few minutes. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, David Moore and Bob Nelson here once again. And we were talking about planning deals and successfully completing transactions. Today's marketplace, it's tight. Things are sort of, you better be set to go. If you don't have things locked up, they're going to go away. Sometimes they go away anyway.
Yes.
But if we look at the ID rules, and you've been doing this long enough, Bob, you've got an early CI number. But you think about pre-1991, people could identify virtually anything they wanted.
Right.
You don't want to identify a county, fine, do it.
Right.
And I think the old saying, you hear the saying, buyers are liars, and I think you know that sort of evolved out of that process. Yeah, I want your property. Yeah, I'm going to tie it up. Well, you better know where you are.
Right.
And in 91, we had a lot of tightening of 1031, formalization of it, and they gave us some ID rules, three different identification options that are there today. And you only have to meet one of them. You don't have to meet all three.
Right.
But if we look at the three different rules, you got the three property rule, 200% rule, the 95% rule. What do most of your clients work with? I mean, what do you typically see or what do you like to work with? I know you're probably not a fan of the 95% rule.
No.
It might put a little pressure on you, but
it puts a lot of pressure on you. Because you can identify as many things as you'd like of any value without a value limitation, but you have to buy 95% of that which you've identified. Well, what happens to one of the properties? A guy leaves and goes to Europe for 6 months and can't be found. Guess what? You've just blown that one wide open. To violate those rules is to cause the transaction to be fully taxable. So you can't afford to have that happen. It's an interesting process. So in advance of the time that we potentially even offer the downleg property, the property that I'm going to be going out of on the exchange, which I refer to as the downleg, before we offer that for sale, we need to come up with a game plan of how it's going to work, what we're after. Are we after a number of different properties, smaller properties that we might be exchanging our one property into, or are we after one that's even larger than what we have? And we're given an opportunity then to identify as many as three properties. So it's important if a person owns a property free and clear that they're selling and they want to stay free and clear, then that has pretty much defined what they're going to be doing. They're going to be exchanging same value into other assets. They could acquire more things, but they're not going to be acquiring very many more things because real estate's expensive as a single priced product. So most likely they're going to be sticking with the three property rule that I have people that have done going from one big thing into a number of smaller things with the idea of they have debt on the one that they're selling and they would like to place that much debt, which they have to replicate in their exchange. They like to place that against only several of the properties and end up with other properties owned free and clear.
Yeah.
So it may be advantageous for them to have a series of things free and clear with all of the debt stacked against one or two things. It depends on the transaction. But it's really a function of where they're trying to go.
So I sort of encourage people, one example of a transaction we did years ago, somebody gave up a single asset, mm-hmm. bought 24 properties,
yes.
replacement properties. Well, the client was a CPA, and she knew the cost of a single sale fail. If you don't close 95% of the aggregate value of all properties ID'd, you're going to lose the exchange.
Right.
So she, with her background, knew, hey, I got to get it done inside the 45, so she did it.
Yep.
But with that said, you made an important point. A lot of times if we've got somebody coming in and they've got no debt, a whole nother conversation, we can talk about it in another video, the napkin test, value equity across or up. You're going to hear a lot of people say, well, you got to replace debt. That's not entirely true.
Debt
can go away two ways. You can go down in value, which triggers taxes. You went down in value. The other way debt goes away is by adding cash.
Right.
When we had the recession, we had lots of people adding cash. The loan to value was decreased. Mm-hmm. The banks just weren't making those loans. And you remember, I'm sure you had lots of transactions where people were saying, well, gee, do I need to pay the property off prior to the disposition because I don't want any debt on the replacement? And that's really an irrelevant conversation.
Right.
You can always add money. So don't,
right.
The debt itself is not a problem. What we're concerned about is value and equity. But what I was going to say, the point I really want to make is that you're not stuck. So often people come in, they say, well, hey, I can only ID three properties. I can only buy three properties. It's not true. It's never been the case.
Right.
You're working with the three property rule, the 200% rule, or that 95% rule.
And these are things that you need to know about well in advance of the time that you offer your property for sale. And frequently that sale results as an unidentified buyer walking through the door, making an offer to you on your property that you had never intended to sell. And all of a sudden it's an offer you simply can't refuse. And then you slam into gear trying to do a tax deferred exchange, and guess what? And maybe that's a cash buyer and he wants to close next Friday. We have no opportunity to pre-plan that transaction. So it's kind of a hit and miss situation, and that's a horrible transaction to try to engineer. And I consider myself to be an exchange engineer. And if there's a way of doing it and we have to buy several properties, I'm going to potentially go after the largest one first to eliminate the majority of the tax consequence. If I can't buy other properties, at least I've deferred the majority of the tax consequence in buying the very first one.
So what if somebody came to you, Bob, said, look, I'm giving up this property. I've got no debt on it.
Right.
But I want to lever into several different replacement properties.
Right.
Let's say one of them would satisfy the exchange.
Right.
Wouldn't a great solution be just to buy the one via the
exactly.
exchange and then do a cash out refi and lever in the balance of the properties in a period of time where you don't have time constraints?
Right.
And another benefit of that strategy would be that the purchase price of those other properties is now your basis. You're not deferring gains into
those
right. things.
You have a full stepped up basis because you've acquired the thing as a purchase. At the same time, if it has to roll as an exchange, and my client has been pre-approved by a lender to a certain amount of debt capacity, that has to do with their global financial position. It has nothing to do with the property. They have the capacity to service debt if negative cash flow were to occur. So they'll be looking at this person with more favor. So if I can go after the largest one that satisfies the exchange, and have the lender standing by with a certain amount of debt, I simply can either apply as much as is required to buy the property with this much debt opportunity left over. So what happens? I get to satisfy the exchange with the very first property, but with more purchasing capacity and borrowing capacity, now I can go after a second or a third property, and it makes it a rather interesting process.
So let me ask you this real
yes.
quick. So if you're working with the 200% rule or the 95% rule, we're talking
right.
about values.
Right.
What if the property's not on the market? What are you telling people?
Yeah.
What are they worth? And,
yeah.
and you know, I joke with brokers all the time. I say, well, of course you have to have a broker to sell a property or list property. And you know, if I go back to the audit manual that we had in roughly 1990, late
right.
80s, talking about 1031s, one of the questions was the property on the market at the time of identification, which is irrelevant. I mean,
right.
it means nothing. A property
right.
doesn't have to be on the market. So how often does somebody say, hey, I want this thing,
yeah.
and it's not on the market? How
right.
often?
Well, and on top of that, let's take it one notch further. Let's say that you're going after four or five or six properties, which is allowed by the 200% rule, and you've marked down on a piece of paper that property A is worth this, B, C, and so forth. You add them up, and it is below the 200% of your sale price. So restated, that qualifies. What happens then if you've marked down this property is $500,000, but in final negotiation you had to pay $600,000 for it? What's just happened? You've gone over the top. What happens if you violate that rule? That is an unforgiving rule. So it takes a lot of skill and negotiation up front to make sure that you're within the capacity of qualifying for the exchange. And if anything goes wrong, you may have a bombshell that all your good work as a broker goes right down the drain. And of course, the client's not pleased with your name from that point forward because they've just incurred tax.
Well, I appreciate the conversation. And, you know, something else that people don't think about is, you know, that 45-day time period is critical.
Yeah.
You've got to have things set up. You got to be committed come that 45th day to either completing the transaction or not completing the transaction. And we'll talk about that again in a few minutes. Thank you.
Thank you.